Well, the Acheson family of St. Mary's, Ontario are my kind of knuckleheads. Derek, Josh, and Darren Acheson had a goofy goal. They wanted to set foot in all five Great Lakes in one day. Think about that. All five Great Lakes, one day. Do the math. That requires some planning. But back on June 27th, they pulled it off. 3:45 a.m. alarm in St. Mary's, Ontario. I believe that's right across the river from Port Huron, if I'm not mistaken. They drove to Hamilton, Ontario. And at 6 a.m., they jumped into Lake Ontario. By 7:30, they had jumped into Lake Erie at Port Dover in Ontario. Then it was on to Linwood, Michigan, about 10 minutes north of Bay City. And they jumped in and jumped out. It looked rather amusing, I imagine. Three guys jumping into the water, frolicking around for 30 seconds, then getting out and getting in the car and driving to the next stop, all the way to Petoskey and Lake Michigan. Then all the their first trip across the Mackinac Bridge into the Upper Peninsula, they made it to Brimley State Park, their overnight spot, at 7 p.m. and about 7:15 p.m. They jumped into Lake Superior, 15 hours, more than 620 miles, but they did it. The Achesons of St. Mary's, Ontario, dipped into all five Great Lakes in a single day. And there, and now you know, it has been done, it can be done. Well done, Achesons. It's current state here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the top of our program today, Michigan Democrats are hoping a U.S. Supreme Court decision from last week might level the state's political playing field. In an Arizona case, the High Court ruled that a state's voters have the right to establish independent commissions to draw the boundary lines that mark legislative and congressional districts. In most states, including Michigan, that authority lay with its legislature. That means that every 10 years, the majority party holds the pen and redraws the districts as it sees fit. The process commonly leads to gerrymandering, weirdly drawn districts designed to ensure that the party in power, and in Michigan, that is the GOP, remains so. For many years, critics have blasted the practice as a distortion of democracy. Our next guest is enthusiastic about the Supreme Court ruling and is a vocal supporter of redistricting reform. Jocelyn Benson is the current dean of the Wayne State University Law School. She was the Democratic candidate for Michigan Secretary of State back in 2010. Welcome, Jocelyn Benson.
Thanks for having me.
In your view, how big a problem is gerrymandering in Michigan? Where do we really see it?
Well, I think we see it in Michigan. I mean, you need to look no further than the drawing of the 14th Congressional District, which literally snakes around Oakland County, grouping voters from Pontiac down through Detroit into the southwest area of Detroit and Grosse Pointe. So it's a very strange district that's been nationally called one of the oddest shaped districts in the country. So that, I think, demonstrates, as Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said several decades ago, if a district looks funny or is funny or oddly shaped, there's probably something wrong with it.
Mm-hmm. I've joked before that these are shapes not found in nature. And I think there's probably a case to be made there. But
well, and you know, the thing that I found in 2011 when the districting process was happening in Lansing and elected officials were drawing the lines is that I led a redistricting competition inviting citizens to draw maps for Michigan's congressional seats because we wanted to demonstrate that if citizens given the opportunity, maybe they could do a better job. And we found that they did. In fact, the winning map created competitive, compact districts across the state. It was drawn by the then president of the College Republicans at Central Michigan University, and it complied with all state and federal laws and showed that it is possible. And unfortunately, the legislators didn't choose that map, but I think had we an independent redistricting commission, we'd see much better districts as a result.
Very interesting. Is your hope for an independent state commission for Michigan then, like as in Arizona, for example?
Yes, I think Arizona and California provide great examples for Michigan to follow. These are two states that have a little slightly different models, but they've done it. There have been a few cycles, so we can see the result. And I think California is a great example. Over 25,000 people applied to be a part of the commission when it was selected a few years ago. and they applied to the state auditor, and 14 were ultimately selected through a multi-tiered process. And the resulting map that was adopted after several open hearings and a lot of transparency was disliked by both political parties, which I think demonstrates that it was probably nonpartisan.
Hmm. Critics have said there is no guarantee that an independent commission can't become partisan and could conceivably indulge in gerrymandering. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I'm sure you could make that argument, and I would respond two ways. One, the current process is problematic. It is broken, and we've seen in other states that this is a way to fix it. So I think certainly you could make the argument that that politics and partisanship can invade anything, especially when you're dealing with the allocation of votes and political power like you are here. But what we've seen in California is that if you have a multi-layered process that involves everything from veto power. In fact, both parties have the ability to reject people from being a part of the commission, and then a certain amount of distance from the process that can insulate it as much as possible from partisan politics, where you have members of the public who are not drawing their own districts, they're simply drawing districts for the public. That can remove some of the self-interest that we see in the current process and bring us closer to a more open democratic process.
Dean Jocelyn Benson of the Wayne State University Law School is our guest. She is an advocate of redistricting reform, and where our conversation stems directly from last week's Supreme Court ruling, which approves the rights of states to appoint independent commissions to draw the boundary lines that mark legislative and congressional districts. Jocelyn, should we assume that most state legislatures are going to resist a move like this, or are there examples of state? I mean, obviously, it's happened in California and Arizona and a few others. I mean, should we assume that in most cases state legislatures are going to resist this?
I think so. I mean, certainly politicians elected out of gerrymandered districts have no incentive to fix the very system that that elected them. And in Arizona and California, it was voters leading an initiative campaign that led the way for the reform. And in fact, the Supreme Court case was entitled Arizona State Legislature versus the Independent Redistricting Commission.
Yeah.
So it was literally the legislators versus the public, and the public won. So I think in Michigan, we had the opportunity to amend our Constitution to create this reform, and the Supreme Court has essentially endorsed our ability to do so. I think it was a call to action for us to reexamine our process in Michigan and hopefully enact some change through the initiative process.
This brings us to Democratic State Representative John Hoadley. He says he's launching an effort to get this before voters on November 2016's ballot in the general election. I take it that for advocates of reform, this is a promising possibility.
Well, Representative Hoadley has been a longtime supporter of opening up the democratic process and promoting these types of reforms, so it's no surprise that he's introducing legislation in a few weeks on this, as his predecessor, Representative Sean McCann, did when he held that seat. But I do think, and I think it's great that there are representatives out there who are willing to put this reform forward, but a real reform needs to come, I think, from the grassroots and from the citizens. And we see the League of Women Voters out there doing great work to in town hall meetings to have a conversation with voters across the state and citizens across the state about the opportunities to make our redistricting process more open and more fair. So I think it's going to involve a lot of people and a lot of conversations before we get to the point of any type of initiative on the ballot. And I'm you know, excited to see where this goes. I can tell you I've been involved in this work for a long time, and I've never seen the type of enthusiastic response that I've seen since the Supreme Court decision came out for this type of reform in Michigan.
In your view, are too few Michigan residents aware of the impact of gerrymandering?
Well, it is a wonky process. It's this idea of drawing districts, and it doesn't directly relate to road funding or whether or not our children are getting a good education. Yet it does. It does affect every decision that is made out of the legislature, from how much taxes we pay to whether we have good schools to whether our roads are fixed. So I think what voters ultimately see, and we've seen this in other states, is the connection between the way the districts are drawn and the policies that come out of the legislature, which essentially are both rife with self-interest and driven by special interests. So by removing the politics from the redistricting process as much as possible, I think we can get a little bit closer to a democracy that is really for and of the people as opposed to special interests.
Could it be that more voters are aware of gerrymandering and the impact of it, and that there are simply more Republican voters who want to maintain the status quo? I look at the winners of statewide offices where gerrymandering is not an issue, and I see Rick Snyder, I see Ruth Johnson, I see Bill Schuette. I mean, there are still a lot of Republicans in the state.
Well, to me, it's really not a Republican-Democratic issue. It's about a system that's broken, and it's a system that's broken because it's driven by self-interest. No matter who's drawing the line, if you're literally choosing your own voters, drawing your own district, that's a problem, no matter what party you affiliate with. So that's the problem that redistricting reform is trying to fix, to take the pen out of the hands of the elected officials, regardless of what party they're in, and put it in the hands of the people so that they can draw the districts that they want to use to elect their representatives.
Dean Jocelyn Benson of the Wayne State University Law School is our guest here today on WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan Republicans, of course, controlled the process in both 2011 and 2001. Historically, have Democrats been accused of gerrymandering as well? Do you know?
Yes, it is a problem that's afflicted both parties, quite frankly. When you have partisan self-interest ruling the day, that is going to infect the process of drawing districts. So if you look next door to Illinois, you see the opposite, where Democrats have gerrymandered districts to their favor in the way that is similarly problematic. And to me, the real reform, the test of a real independent commission comes with the question of is neither party happy, but are the voters happy? And that's what we see in states that have these type of independent redistricting commissions.
New York Times columnist Nate Cohn wrote in a fairly challenging piece last week, cautioning that this decision is hardly a panacea for Democrats who would like to see a more level playing field. And one reason that he cited is that elected legislatures in some states, California being one, may well draw more favorable districts than an independent commission. Is that a valid point in your view?
Well, it's a question of what is a favorable district and what do we want our districting process to look like? What do we want our districts to look like? And to me, those questions need to be answered by voters and by citizens, not by politicians. And that to me is the bottom line. And yes, no one's saying that any one reform is going to perfect our democracy. Our democracy has a lot of is very far in view in many, including my own, from the views of the founding father of an open and transparent process that's deliberative and representative and all the rest. But make no mistake, I think this reform is very clearly a step in the right direction of fixing what is currently a problem with the system and creating a more fair, more independent opportunity for citizens to have a voice in the representative process.
It would seem that the work that the League of Women Voters and Common Cause and such groups are undertaking may well play a critical role here in awareness raising, I guess you could call it. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think what we've seen so far and what the country is that voters are very excited about this. They're very engaged in the process, and they want to hear more about how they can play a role. And so there is, I think, an opportunity for many conversations to happen around the state with this Supreme Court opinion coming out about what it means for Michigan. And the League of Women Voters is doing a great job leading that way.
I do want to spend 1 minute on the Supreme Court decision itself. Some people think the ruling was notable, given the Elections Clause of the Federal Constitution, which says, and I quote, "The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof," unquote. That seems pretty explicit. Were you at all surprised, given that the court ruled the way it did?
Well, what the court recognized, no, I wasn't surprised, because the court recognized that the legislature is ultimately comprised of the people, number one, and number two, that the legislature has the ability to transfer its power of legislating to the people if it so chooses. So what the court said is if you create the ability for citizens to amend their constitution through the initiative process, if the legislature creates that ability, then that is essentially ceding that ability, that authority to the voters, and they have every right to use it to enact laws that they that they favor. So I think the opinion brings us a lot closer to a more direct representative democracy that our founders envisioned, and broadly interprets that word legislature to recognize that voters are essentially a part of the legislative process.
We want to thank our guest, Dean Jocelyn Benson, Dean of the Wayne State University Law School, Democratic candidate for Michigan Secretary of State in 2010. We have been talking about redistricting reform, an important conversation. Thanks for your insights.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, every day at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m., every day at noon, every weekday at noon on AM 870 WKAR. Thank you for joining us. You can learn a lot about the character and culture of a region through the novels, short stories, and fiction written by its local authors. There's the dark humor of the Southern Gothic tradition and the adventure of countless pioneer stories set in the American West. But the Midwest hasn't always had a cohesive literary identity, despite producing some of the country's most famous storytellers. That's one of the reasons our next guest was excited to dig into the literary history of her home state. Anna Clark is a freelance journalist and writer living in Detroit and is the author of Michigan's Literary Luminary. She joins us by phone now. Welcome to Current State, Anna.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Sure. What made you want to write this book?
Oh, well, just as you were saying in the introduction, I think there's a really rich literary culture here that we have, and we have a lot to be proud of here in Michigan and certainly the Midwest more broadly. But it's a story that we haven't really told about ourselves, certainly not on the level that we've celebrated our music heritage or our visual arts heritage. And I just felt that the stories of our storytellers are ones worth telling.
Name a few of the authors that you chose to profile in this book and why you chose them. I mean, what exactly qualifies someone as a literary luminary here in Michigan?
Well, one of the things that haunts me is that the book is in no way able to touch on all the immensely talented writers that we've produced here. But I did spend a lot of time focusing on Ernest Hemingway, of course, in the North Woods, Elmore Leonard in Detroit, the poet Theodore Roeke from Saginaw, Robert Hayden, the first African-American poet, U.S. poet laureate, who is from Detroit, and a number of others. I think when you're talking about, like, what qualifies people as, you know, sort of, you know, as being a sort of literary luminary, like, I think that I didn't mean this book to be sort of like a countdown of like the very best writers exactly, but I did want to focus on people who are doing really thoughtful, introspective work in a variety of genres, a variety of styles and eras, who do work that accounts for the place that they come from in some way.
As I mentioned earlier, there are some regions of the country that have really identifiable, defining literary traditions. Why do you think the Midwest has arguably lacked that same kind of cohesive literary identity?
Well, it's certainly not for the lack of producing extraordinary writers or those writers focusing on this place in their work. I mean, there are just legions of like some of the very best work of the, you know, past 100 years and beyond that have been embedded in this place. And I think, you know, I was really thinking a lot about that, about why this isn't something that's like known and recognized even by ourselves in a certain way. I think it has to do with a number of things. I think one of them is that the Midwest is such a broad region, you know, with really, you know, like where the borders of the Midwest are themselves kind of up for debate, you know? Like, people might question whether, I don't know, South Dakota counts as the Midwest.
Right.
And so I think some of that porousness is part of why that that cohesive tradition hasn't developed in some way. And also because there's just such a diversity of writers that have come from here. I mean, that, you know, the writers who focus on, like, our, you know, grand old cities like Chicago and Detroit, you know, are in many ways different than those who focused on like the rural landscapes, you know, in Winesburg, Ohio, or in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and you know, trying to like put them next to each other, you know, can maybe like present some kind of simplifications of their work that like don't quite make sense. I mean, you just got to acknowledge that they're really different kinds of writers, even if they come from the same kind of region. On the other hand, I feel like there are commonalities that I think we can recognize when we look at these writers. And some of that would be, for example, that, you know, whether they're in, you know, small town writers or big city writers, their work is, you know, has a very particular attention to the landscape they're in. You know, like there's a real nuanced eye on the people, the landscape, the just the natural world, you know, that's around them, and that I think is, you know, very unique to a lot of Midwestern writers. And I think there's another commonality, I think, is that, and this is like an idea I've borrowed from the Kalamazoo writer Bonnie Jo Campbell, is that there's something in the work of Midwestern writers that is informed by some of that like Southern Gothic tradition, because Michigan is a state that has been and that has been so impacted by the Great Migration from the South. You know, I mean, and some of that eye has like informed our own literary tradition up here in the North. You know, including how we treat our eccentrics, you know, the characters in our communities who are a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And I think that shows up in a lot of the work of some of these writers.
Our guest is Anna Clark, a freelance journalist and writer living in Detroit and the author of Michigan's Literary Luminaries. We're talking about what may constitute a Midwest literary identity here for Michigan and the broader Midwest as well. To play off on that last point, Anna, it does seem like in recent years there's been a growing interest on the literary history and traditions of the region as a rust belt. What do you think might be driving that interest?
Yes, absolutely. I think part of what's like driving that is simply the last 10 years or so, 15 years or so have been really hard on this region of the country. And as your listeners well know, I mean, the recession has hit us so deeply, and we've been going through, you know, a generation's worth of like, you know, economic restructuring, and the kind of uncertainty that's like brought to us has, it's just been transformative in very painful ways often. And I think that, that's also like propelled this region into the national, even international spotlight in some ways. I'm here in Detroit, and that's, of course, you know, been making headlines, you know, for since about 2009 or so, especially when the automakers were, you know, in Washington, D.C. And I think that's kind of created an opportunity for a lot of the writers here to start reflecting on what their identity is here in this place, to start thinking about like what stories, even, you know, when there's a lot of journalism covering the area, what stories are not yet told, who are the people whose voices are not yet, given space. And I think that's like, and then I think that's also given some opportunities for writers to even, you know, get their work out there. Writers who've been, you know, telling these stories all along, but now that there's been this like greater interest in this region, they're having opportunities to like publish and get that work out there in a new way.
You're an avid reader and a literary journalist yourself, so I'm sure you knew some of the history of Michigan storytellers before you started writing the book. But was there anything you came across that really surprised you while writing the book?
Yes, so much. And that was actually a lot of the fun, was like doing some of the plain old reporting, you know, and having that discovery, you know, propel this book. A few things really surprised me. One was how long it took the communities in northern Michigan to really like embrace its Hemingway legacy. It was something that was, you know, not kept secret exactly, but like just it wasn't really put at the forefront of the local heritage until, you know, really in the last 10 years or so. And, you know, a lot of that can be credited to a group of volunteers called the Michigan Hemingway Society that have been, you know, made it their mission to make sure that all the local libraries have books by Hemingway, things like that, you know. And it just surprised me that it took a while, you know, for that to really be something that the communities there rallied around. And another thing that really, well, I don't know if it was a surprise, but it was such a welcome discovery, was one of the authors I spent a lot of time with in the book. Her name's Harriet Simpson Arno. I had never heard of her before, but she's incredible. And she was really well-known and acclaimed in her time. She's been too easily forgotten, I think. I mean, she kept being a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award. She's a bestseller. She kept losing to Faulkner, unfortunately, in some of those big prizes. but she's this wonderful writer. She came from Kentucky, part of that southern migration north, lived a little while in Detroit, and then most of her the last half of her life around Ann Arbor. And her work is just like The Dollmaker. It's one of her best known novels. It just has like this wonderful ear for the voices of this place and the different kinds of characters that call it home.
We've got less than a minute, Anna, but I do want to ask you about Write a House. You're involved in, this is a literary project in Detroit that's really interesting. Tell us quickly about that.
Sure. We're a nonprofit that purchases longtime vacant homes in Detroit. We renovate them with the help of vocational education programs, and we have a competitive contest where the winner literally gets to keep the house forever for keeps. We gave away our first house to a poet from Brooklyn who moved in November. She's doing wonderfully. We're currently in the process of giving away our second house. We're announcing our 10 finalists next month.
How interesting. My gosh, I've never heard of anything like that. That is fabulous. I'm afraid we're out of time, but we want to stay in touch with you, especially about the Write a House project. Fascinating. We've been talking about Michigan's literary past and future. I beg your pardon, with Anna Clark, author of the book Michigan Literary Luminaries and a freelance journalist living in Detroit. Anna, thanks much for joining us.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
Coming up on Current State, our Neighbors in Action segment this week looks at Camp Liberty in Jackson County. It's a volunteer operation that gives veterans a chance to spend time outdoors enjoying activities like fishing, hunting, hiking, and canoeing. Also, Current State contributor Dr. Kirk Heinze informs us about the city of East Lansing and its updated recycling program. That and more coming up after the break on Current State. We want to congratulate a team from Meridian Township who recently placed first in a competition to reduce carbon footprints and boost physical activity. 34 members of the Primed Meridian team won this competition with over 1,000 smart commutes, which are trips involving anything other than a one-driver, one-motorized vehicle. And Rick Brown, a Meridian Township Associate Planner and the captain of the Primed Meridian team, led the team with 77 smart commutes. That might even include kayaking, by the way. Anything but being alone in your car constituted a smart commute, I guess. So hats off to the Meridian Township team there. The Mid-Michigan Environmental Action Council sponsors that event. Wednesday on Current State means it's time for Neighbors in Action, when we feature people and organizations working to make Greater Lansing a better place. Today we hear about Camp Liberty in Jackson County. The idea behind Camp Liberty is to give veterans dealing with post-traumatic stress a chance to spend time outdoors with activities like hunting, fishing, canoeing, and hiking. We're joined today by Camp Liberty founder Rick Briggs, a retired U.S. Air Force major, along with Purple Heart veteran Sean Knudsen, who has been both a participant and a volunteer at Camp Liberty. Welcome to Current State to both of you. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it a lot.
Thank you very much.
How do activities... you refer to invisible wounds, Rick. How do activities like hunting, camping, fishing, hiking help a veteran with invisible wounds?
What we use at Camp Liberty is all of these outdoor programs to get our young men and women together to get them to open up. Camp Liberty serves as a conduit to getting them to be more receptive about the ideas that invisible wounds, traumatic brain injury, TBI, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, these are invisible wounds, but they are treatable. The 22 suicides a day we're experiencing right now within our veteran community are a pretty blatant indicator of the failure of our system to
adequately
address.
I was not ready for that statistic. 22 a day.
22 a day, yeah. And more than a fair share of them are young Iraq and Afghanistan vets.
Yeah.
They're dealing with five major issues. If you've seen American Sniper, you know about moral injuries, the horrible decisions they have to make in a combat environment on our behalf. But there's not just the moral things. It's the divorce, the homelessness, joblessness, incarceration rates are through the roof, and then the suicides. And what we do is we get them outdoors, we get the vets together with people they know, like, and trust. They open up more, and they're more receptive to hearing about treatment opportunities because invisible wounds are treatable.
Mm. Where in Jackson County are you?
We're right on Austin Road. It's a Brooklyn address down in the Irish Hills area. We got a half a mile of river frontage on the River Raisin. So it's between Napoleon and Manchester.
Sean, you served in the U.S. Army and the Michigan Army National Guard in places like Central America, Germany, the Baltics, Kuwait, and Iraq. Why did you first go to Camp Liberty?
I heard about it through Rick Briggs, and I know for a fact that being outdoors, it restores the soul. It does a lot for veterans and anybody that enjoys the outdoors. But my primary goal was to go and get away and deal with my own PTSD problems. PTSD literally robs your mind of reason. And getting outdoors in a place like Camp Liberty or anywhere in Michigan and getting away from things, it restores reason, it restores calm and peace and serenity. But it's also an opportunity for me to go there to help other veterans and their families as well. Helping other veterans and families is a huge way for veterans like myself to recover over time and to heal ourselves.
Did you anticipate becoming a volunteer when you made your first visit, or was that something that just sprang organically from your own participation?
Never anticipated being a volunteer. Just the minute I saw it, I fell in love with it. And I've done a lot of things with Rick Briggs and the Brain Injury Association in the past, and I knew right away that this was an opportunity for myself and for my family. And it was an opportunity for literally thousands of other veterans and their families as well.
Our Neighbors in Action focus today is on Camp Liberty, a spot in Jackson County where veterans can go to enjoy nature. Founder Rick Briggs, a retired U.S. Air Force major, is our guest, along with Sean Knudsen, a Purple Heart recipient who volunteers there. Rick, do you have eligibility requirements for access to Camp Liberty?
It is a restricted access in that we just can't. It's a small facility. It's 137 acres, so we have to control the numbers and so on, and we do want the serenity and the privacy. We want to optimize the wilderness impact. We have, by the end of this summer, we'll have over $35,000 worth of wildlife habitat in place, a pond, and 18 different kinds of wildflowers. And folks can go on our website and see a lot of amazing photos of that. But it's open to everybody, not just the Iraq-Afghanistan troops, even though those are the ones that will be able to optimize their treatment, because a brain injury treatment and it needs to be treated as soon after injury as possible. But, it is open to everybody.
Sean Knudsen, are all of the Camp Liberty volunteers veterans like yourself?
Not all of them are veterans. A good majority work through other programs, but a lot of them are familiar with veterans, or they have family members that are veterans. So they have that link and that connection, and they have that understanding. And they also have the desire to help and to be a part of what we're trying to accomplish at Camp Liberty.
There's an intense discussion underway to get away from the acronym PTSD, dropping the D for disorder, and the idea is to remove the stigma of having a disorder. Do you support that notion?
I support it. I think that in reality, it's a disease. It's an illness that affects majority of combat veterans. So I definitely would agree with dropping disorder.
Rick Briggs, how did you get started for yourself in this effort to help veterans?
My son got orders to Iraq early on in the war, and I actually headed up the Operation Helmet project early on to get the ballistic liner upgrade kits for the helmets. This is before the Department of the Defense was actually providing these liners. It reduces the ballistic shock wave by up to 60%, and I wanted my son to have one of these, so I was unemployed for 9 months. We started up the Michigan chapter of this. It was Cher, Sonny and Cher. She was our national spokesman, and we wound up getting the DOD to actually procure these helmet liners, and now it's standard issue for all our branches of service.
I wanted to ask you about the women veterans. Mm-hmm. It's open to women veterans, but families participate as well. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, we have women's programs. We have men's, faith-based, all of these different, including children. There's a lot of secondary and tertiary PTSD that happens in a family. It's not just the veteran that's dealing with this, and it's one of the primary contributors to divorce and so on. So the family has to heal together. And so right now, in fact, we are in the process of building a beautiful program center where we'll be able to facilitate getting families out there together, and they can heal together in the beautiful Michigan outdoors.
How long will it take to make that program center happen? Do you have a timeline or anything like that?
Well, you know, next week would be nice, but reality is probably, I hope to open it by October and have it fully functioning.
Are there other operations like Camp Liberty around the country?
Yeah, there's a Camp Hope in Missouri, and there's a Camp Freedom in Maryland. We're the only ones with a direct tie-in like we have. We're sponsored by Eisenhower Center, who's been all over national news for their After the Impact program, which works with the NFL football players, sports concussion and that, and then they pair up veterans with NFL players as a tandem while they go through treatment. It's a wonderful program. And so Camp Liberty is not a treatment facility, but we're a conduit for getting them to open up and be receptive to listening about treatment, because only 50% of the troops are even registering with the VA, let alone, and even lesser of them are getting the treatment itself. So these are treatable issues. They don't need to live with this and struggle like they are, but anybody who has a combat veteran in the family knows they don't open up and talk about their issues.
Sean Knudsen, you have seen the world thanks to the U.S. Military, the U.S. Army, and the Michigan Army National Guard, Central America, Kuwait, Iraq. Which is your most memorable stop on your military career?
My most memorable would definitely be the Middle East with Iraq and Kuwait. Had the most profound impact on my life. I formed larger bonds with my fellow veterans in Iraq and Kuwait in a combat zone than I did anywhere else around the world. Mm-hmm. But my recruiter didn't lie. He said, if you stay in long enough, you'll see the world. And that's exactly what I did. So,
is there a story that captures the good that Camp Liberty is doing, Rick, that you can share with us, somebody who's really clearly benefited from the program?
We got a call, and it's probably 14 months ago now, from the wife of a disabled Iraq vet, and her husband was 100% disabled infantry, and she was 100% disabled combat medic. And her husband was in the basement, wouldn't come out, interact with the family, two young children, wouldn't go out in the community, and was spiraling down very badly. And literally there was like a Tuesday or Wednesday I got the call. On that Saturday, we were hosting a pheasant hunt up by Clare, Michigan, and I convinced them to come up to the event. And this her husband came up, and she came up, and there were two dozen vets on this pheasant hunt, and he wouldn't even come in the small building where we were having the barbecue and talking, even though they're all veterans. And by the end of that hunt, he was in there socializing, walking around. Mm. You could just see the transformation. We got him out to Camp Liberty the next week. We got him into the After the Impact program, and now he's out in the community. And, you know, there's still struggles. There's still work to be done, but he's fully employed. Their marriage is sound. She has been through that PTSD treatment for her combat medic issues. And as a family, they're together now and moving forward because of outdoor recreation and the opportunity it provided for them to hear the message. And it's not just you can't just lead a horse to water and make them drink. You can tell them about the treatment, but they have to want to get better.
Yeah, yeah, that is so edifying to hear that, though. And God bless both of you for what you're doing. We wish you both nothing but success here involving Camp Liberty. We've been talking with Camp Liberty founder Rick Briggs and participant volunteer Sean Knudsen, a Purple Heart recipient. Thanks to both of you for serving your country and for what you're doing to help your fellow veterans and for telling us more about Camp Liberty on this week's Neighbors in Action segment. Best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State. Tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. The Greening of the Great Lakes is an occasional feature here on Current State, hosted by Current State contributor Dr. Kirk Heinze. Today, Kirk learns about how the city of East Lansing is updating its recycling program from Kathy DeChambeau, Environmental Services Administrator with the East Lansing Department of Public Works and Environmental Services.
Well, we're really excited about this. For about 2 years, we've been planning to dramatically change our curbside recycling system. East Lansing was one of the first communities in the area to have curbside recycling with the open-top blue bins that people have been very familiar with. We started in 1991, and basically those blue bins are not serving our purposes at this point in time. So it's taken us about 2 years to plan for this implementation because we really needed to change the infrastructure of our recycling program. We needed automated vehicles, which are not cheap. We needed to purchase at least one new vehicle. We've actually purchased two for this purpose because we will need both vehicles. And then you need to purchase carts for our residents. And our goal all along was really to have these carts given to our residents at no cost. We knew that that would create additional buy-in and get people really excited about the program.
Make it as convenient as possible.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's our goal. So, you know, the city's goal of waste reduction, which is one of the five tenets of our climate sustainability plan, this really goes along with that because we'll be able to increase our recycling volumes and increase the materials that are diverted from the landfill. And we're really excited about that.
Yeah, I know you guys are all over single stream, and I know that residents talking to other folks around the state really like the convenience of that. But part of your new program, and you mentioned it, is to expand the materials that can actually go in the bin.
Right, Kirk. So right now, we cannot collect materials, really common materials like boxboard and cardboard, curbside. We can certainly take those materials at our drop-off site, but an 18-gallon blue bin is not a method that you can collect very much cardboard with. And our current vehicles were made to be source-separated vehicles back when source-separated recycling was really the common way to do curbside recycling. We've adopted those vehicles as much as possible to take as many materials as we can, but they still don't have the volume that we need to be able to add cardboard and additional materials. Not only that, our residents should have the convenience of a rolled cart that's lidded and protected from the elements. That's a really big thing. And when you think about a dense urban environment and even just a little bit of spill out of an open top bin creates a litter issue for us in the city. And so on a windy day when you have your newspaper and your open top bin, it's just really
easy. Or one of those tough February days when the wind
exactly.
and the snow is howling. That's right.
Exactly. And the bin freezes to the ground and our staff has to try to pick it up. It's just not a convenient method and it's not an efficient method.
Well, the residents are obviously, your numbers in terms of folks who do curbside are pretty impressive.
Yes.
Is there some help with financially or people for these new bins?
Well, we're super excited to have been chosen as one of three communities in the nation for the Recycling Partnership Grant. It's $125,000 to help us with our implementation. So $100,000 towards the actual cart purchase, which for us meant that we can provide these 96-gallon carts for free to all residents
oh, wow.
who qualify for recycling in the city. So that's just an amazing thing, and we're really, really honored to be
there. That's
their
not breaking
partners.
Any hearts among the residents.
No, not at all. I think people are pretty excited about this.
Well, tell us a little bit about these new trucks that you mentioned that are going to be picking up these bins. I mean, they're also energy efficient as well.
Absolutely. So the city of East Lansing adopted a green fleet policy about a year ago, and the goal of that policy is to look at our fleet and look at reducing fuel consumption, reducing emissions, really having cleaner vehicles, looking at alternative technologies. Mm. And so when it came time to look at the purchase of new sanitation recycling vehicles, we said, you know, let's see what's out there. And of course, there's not a lot out there for a truck of that size right. and magnitude, at least for the infrastructure that we have in our area. Compressed natural gas is not quite a good option for us yet here in this area, but a hybrid recycling truck is a great option. So we worked with Parker Runwise. They have a unique system. It's used, it's been out in the market about 4 or 5 years. We talked to a lot of communities that have been using these trucks for several years, and they're absolutely thrilled with them. We demoed one of the trucks back in the fall, so some of our residents saw a little unusual truck. They obviously knew it was a sanitation vehicle. It had the automated arm, but it didn't look like a normal East Lansing truck. There were there were some markings on it that were a little different, and we demoed that truck for 3 weeks, and we really tracked fuel efficiency. We tracked productivity, because the interesting thing about this hybrid is that in a dense urban community like ours, where there are very frequent close together stops, that's where it is most efficient. It's getting the energy from the braking system, and it's actually propelling the truck from stop to stop faster than a normal truck, a diesel run truck would make it. So we saw about a 15% increase in productivity on our routes using that truck, and we saw a 40 to 50% reduction in fuel use.
We're talking about new recycling innovations in the city of East Lansing with Kathy DeChambeau, who is the Environmental Services Administrator for the city of East Lansing. So these trucks are not cheap, but based on what you just said, Kathy, the return on investment has got to be over a fairly short period of time.
Well, we're really excited to work with Parker on this truck. Being the first city in Michigan to have this system on a recycling truck, we want to be sort of the hub of education for other cities. We want to invite other cities to come in, try our truck, talk to our mechanics, talk to our staff about that truck, be able to try it out. And so we're hoping that this system grows out from East Lansing throughout the state like it has in many other states.
Have you found, and this is a sort of a bit of a different question, but in terms of attitudes and trends in the city of East Lansing, are you finding more and more people are asking about green initiatives like the recycling initiatives you've just talked about, or has that sort of always been the case in East Lansing?
I think that's always been the case. There's always been a very strong bend towards going green in East Lansing, of course, and we definitely have seen that. We've had a commission on the environment for many, many years that informs our city council on those kinds of initiatives, and they've been very progressive.
Now, back to the trucks just for a second before I forget, but you had some kind of a public vote in terms of decals or markings on these trucks, and the citizens actually got to select what goes on these trucks?
Yes, we did. Well,
that's pretty cool.
We have an outstanding communication staff, very talented, and so we looked at what other cities did with their truck designs. We wanted this truck to stand out. We want people to know what this truck is about. It really is a unique truck and something that we're very excited to have and very proud to have in our city. And so we wanted an art design on our truck that really reflected what the truck is about, and we wanted to be able to have some information on the truck. So if you saw the truck go by or if you were behind the truck, you would know this is a hybrid truck. And so we did use our eTown Hall series on the city's website to allow for voting, and we put up three designs. And if you voted, design number two, which has a lot of green leaves and is really a lovely design, is the design that won. And we had a lot of people vote. There was a lot of excitement about that. So we're very excited. On the back of the truck, you'll actually see some data about the truck. It says I brake for energy.
Oh, wonderful.
And it'll describe the fuel reduction and emissions reductions that we expect to see.
And when can we expect to see these trucks out on the roads?
Well, we expect to see the truck in East Lansing late August.
Okay.
We're going to take a few weeks to do some training and get the truck settled into the city and take care of all the things we need to do with the truck. And then you'll see it out on the road soon after
That'd be wonderful. We'll be looking for it. And Kathy, we're out of time, but let's get you back on the show to talk about some other green initiatives in the city of East Lansing.
Sounds great.
This was very exciting. I've been talking with the Environmental Services Administrator for the city of East Lansing, Kathy DeChambeau. Kathy, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Kirk.
Current state contributor Dr. Kirk Heinze, host of The Greening of the Great Lakes, also heard on AM 870's MSU Today. Thanks also to Russ White for his assistance. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, 200 Michigan laws include the word marriage. And after last week's Supreme Court ruling legalizing same-sex marriages, all of them need to be reviewed. That job falls to the Michigan Law Revision Commission and its chairman, Richard McClellan. We'll talk to Mr. McClellan about the commission's tasks and challenges. Plus, at a time when segregated social spaces were the norm and black performers were often shuffled in and out of the back doors of performance venues, a group of African American doctors bought land in Northwest Michigan to create an entertainment paradise. That's in Idlewild, Michigan. This weekend, a new generation pays homage to the town's musical heritage with the Idlewild Music Festival. We will learn more. That and more Thursday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Thanks to Drew Hill for engineering. We hope you can join us tomorrow. It's Current State on WKAR. Have a great day.